All right, so in order to introduce the question specific, well, all of the questions, all of the issues that we're talking about involve mitzvot, the performance of mitzvot through language. As a general introduction, I'd like to just look for a moment at the description that Lawrence Fine offers. His topic is Lurianic Kabbalah, but undeniably, the Hasidic masters modeled themselves and their own innovations on the Kabbalistic, the relation of the Kabbalist to halakha in general. So one point that Fine makes here is one of the fundamental facts of the history of Kabbalah was its capacity to remain completely within the folds of Orthodox or normative Judaism, despite its radical innovations. In other words, the issue for the Kabbalists was not whether to practice the mitzvot, but rather their purpose and function. In other words, what Lurianic teaching did was to invest the existing practice with esoteric meaning. In the ultimate purpose of that in Kabbalistic teaching was to empower, here as he says here, to empower its practitioners by cultivating the power of the theurgic power, theosophical power of performing the mitzvot with the ultimate purpose of transforming oneself and the cosmos. I think that we could say that in large part, the Hasidic masters really sort of adopted this view of halakha. They saw themselves as being loyal to halakha, although their opponents, of course, accused them of violating halakha, and that what I want to do today is present some of the texts that arouse the ire of the opponents to Hasidut. But first of all, I'd like to focus on the theoretical underpinnings of their view of language and the way that it manifests itself afterwards in their relation to their teachings, the Hasidic teachings on prayer and on Torah study. So one other point that I'd just like to make, if we're talking about identifying the innovations of Hasidic teaching, we have to keep in mind that much of Hasidic teaching is not indeed innovative. Many of the ideas exist in your earlier texts, but the overall composition of what's done with them is ultimately what is innovative about Hasidic teaching. A case in point, of course, is their view of language, which has its roots in Midrash on the one hand, and in Kabbalistic view of the world on the other. So let's start here with these, it's a couple of sort of basic texts that I assume most people know about. The general idea here is that, as we know, Hashem created the world with language. As a result, the mystical view of language is that it has inherent creative power. We see this in this midrash, the beginning, the first midrash in Bereshit Rabba. I'm going to read here in the Hebrew. Kach haya HaKadosh Baruch Hu mabit b'Torah uvorei et ha'olam. God looked into the world and created into the Torah and created the world. V'Torah amra bereshit bara Elokim in reshit ele Torah. Ha'ach ma da'at amar Hashem koneni reshit darko. The second source that sort of follows along the same line of thinking that the Hebrew language, the Hebrew letters, have intrinsic creative power, is what the Chazal say about Bezalel, that he knew Shebezalel yada letzaref otiyot shenivruhu b'em shamayim va'aretz, that Bezalel manipulated the letters that were used to create heaven and earth. Bezalel, who built the Mishkan, is presented here as the ultimate human creator. The tools that he uses are the same tools that Hashem used to create the world. And not only did he use those tools, but specifically his art was in combining them. So we'll return in a minute to that, this idea of combining the letters specifically within the Hasidic framework. But I'd like to look here for a minute at another foundational text, this one from Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation. Sefer Yetzirah is an anonymously authored, very early Kabbalistic work. It dates from the first century of the Common Era, according to scholars. According to other people, it's attributed to Avraham Avinu. In any case, these are the opening lines of the Sefer Yetzirah, on which much of later Kabbalistic and Hasidic thought is based. 32 נתיבות פליאות פליאות חקק השם י"ק השם צבקות אלוקי ישראל אלוקים חיים כל שקי רם וניסה שוכן עד בקדוש שמו בשלושה ספרים בספר וספר בסיפור. And then the second section, 10 ספירות בלימה ו-12 אותיות יסוד. It's not for nothing that I didn't write down a translation here. I'm not planning to translate this very, very dense text. But just to point out that the thrust of this opening of the Sefer Yetzirah is that Hashem created the world with the 10 sefirot and the 22 letters, the consonants of the Hebrew alphabet. And these all together, 10 plus 22 make 32, and they're called Netivot Chochmah. In other words, Chochmah, wisdom, divine wisdom, we could say, is embodied in the Sefirot and in the letters. Now, based on that idea of God's endless divine wisdom being contracted into the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, the next teaching that we'll look at by the Magid of Mezrich develops this using his classic parable of the father and the son, or the child and the parents. Many of the Magid's teachings are based on this parent-child relationship. I'd like to look at the teaching and unpack it a little bit and try to understand what its implications are for his Hasidic understanding of language. In general, the child receives something from the father's wisdom. His understanding comes from his parents' words, for otherwise the father's wisdom would be too immense and concealed. The child can grasp some part of it because his father has contracted his wisdom, diminishing its fullness and clothing it in words appropriate to the child's understanding. When the child truly devotes his mind to contemplating the words, he receives the wisdom concealed within them, since there everything is utterly one.
Move up the text.
Sorry, that's right. I thought I would, and then I forgot. Sorry about that. Appropriate to the child's understanding. When the child truly devotes his mind to contemplating the words, he receives the wisdom concealed within them, since there everything is utterly one. This is the meaning of the verse, the opening of your words gives light, or open your mouth and let your words illuminate. Chochmah shines from within the word, and its brightness can illuminate another. This gives the father great pleasure. I won't dwell too much on the pshat of the verses that we're talking about. I want to focus on what the Magid is doing with this teaching. First of all, what he's saying is that Hashem contracted his infinite divine wisdom in order to create the world. In other words, the father contracts his adult wisdom in order to be able to enable the child to grasp what he's saying, or to grasp something of that greater wisdom. It happens through language. And interestingly, what the Magid is also saying, the way that the child can understand his father's wisdom is by contemplating his words. Now, the words, on the one hand, diminish the endless potential, the fullness of the father's wisdom, but on the other hand, they also give the child the only opportunity he has to really understand something of what his father intends. Third point, just as Hashem contracts his wisdom into language, So Hashem has contracted his wisdom in the world itself, in the creation of the world itself. In other words, when we contemplate the world, just as when we contemplate the words that describe the world, i.e. the Torah, that too is an avenue that gives us access to Hashem's infinite wisdom. So what we can conclude, I guess, from this parable is that in a sense, what the Maggid is saying is that the world is a text. Just as we read texts and through the interpreting the words, we are able to access some greater message. So when we contemplate the world, we can have access to Hashem's infinite wisdom. To this point, I guess we could say we've dwelt on the interpretive power of the word and of contemplation of the world in order to attain higher understanding of Hashem and of his intentions in running the world. Now, another point that we noted before in the image of Bezalel, that he was able to combine the letters, the next teachings that we'll look at suggest that human beings are able not only to contemplate and gain understanding, but also like Hashem are able to combine the letters or recombine the letters in order to affect reality. Now that it's of course a radical kind of a statement. There are two teachings here, which I did not translate, from the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Ephraim of Sudikov, in his book Degel Machane Ephraim. I'd like to read the first one together, and because I do want to show you how the idea is unpacked through interpreting a verse, happens to be from the Parashat Shavua. So the verse says, "B'chol eretz echuzatchem, ki'ula titnu la'aretz." The whole context is talking about Shemitah and about the necessity of granting liberty to the land in other words, leaving the land fallow in the seventh year. But the word that's used is Giula Tiyeh Ba'aretz. So now the Hasidic master says, Yesh lomar bazeh derech remez, v'nakdim levarer pasuk, zot lifanim b'Yisrael. He, in order to explain, bring his, forward his interpretation, he presents another verse from Rut, v'zot lifanim b'Yisrael, ala Giula v'ala Tmura. This verse appears in the context of Megillat Ruth before Ruth becomes the wife of Boaz and through the mitzvah of symbolically of Yibum. He uses this phrase in a figurative way, ala geula v'ala tmura, that redemption, geula, involves tmura, involves transformation. And now he goes on to say, "Dihinei ha'adam osek v'achila u'masa u'matan, o bedavar midvorim gashmim v'sipurim, tzarich leida ki akol hem otiyot kedoshim." When a person engages in business, or eating, or drinking, or anything that has to do with material life, or telling stories, one has to know that all of those seemingly secular, profane activities involve the holy letters. And when a person is able to do those activities, I'm just sort of free translating here, I don't want to worry you by going through every word. When a person is able to engage in those activities in holiness, through that action, one connects. A person connects those things back up to their root and redeems them. In other words, one redeems them from being only mundane activities, and they become much more. What's he talking about? Does one actually manage to do that? I move down here to the second drasha where he gives some examples. First of all, he brings another important pasuk here. Imrot Hashem, the utterances of Hashem, imrot tehorot, kesef tzavuf. In a simple meaning, Hashem's statements are pure silver. Now he reads these words, kesef tzavuf, in a figurative way, meaning from the word saguf letzagaf, to change the orders of the letters. In other words, the way that things, actions, words, situations can be redeemed is by switching around the letters. Now see here, he actually cites the Baal Shem Tov and gives us some examples. Shatzivufim al yedei chokmato tfilato, that by in one's wisdom and prayers can change their meaning. Kmo min met tam, from dead to pure. From nega leoneg, from disease, plague, to pleasure. These are two classic examples that the Baal Shem Tov gave, in which, as you see, the letters, the order of them is just changed, but we have an absolute radical transformation of being. Now, lest you say, this is just waving a wand and as if one is changing the letters and changes the meaning. The question is, I think that what the Baal Shem Tov is referring to here and what his grandson is explaining in his name is that we have power over the words, just like we have power over our thoughts. If we can change the way we think about things, we can change the way that we name things. In effect, we have the power to change reality. He offers a number of stories about how the Baal Shem Tov actually did that. I won't go into that aspect of it, although certainly for the Hasidim, it was a convincing enough proof that indeed changing the order of the letters can change reality. But I think that what he's getting at here is that the way that we name it is, I guess you could say, a psychological or existential kind of insight, that the way we name things, or the way we conceive of things, the stories we tell ourselves have an effect on not only how we feel about them, but on the reality itself. It's an empowering kind of a statement. Certainly here it has a mystical tint to it. But I think that, this is the basis of many other teachings and guide and elements of guidance in how one can lead a spiritual life. The early Hasidic masters regarded all of these aspects of using language, prayer, telling stories, idle conversations, Torah learning, as essentially being on the same level. All of them have the same power of manipulating language. That's basically what this teaching here in the name of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonai says. I'd like to just continue now, though, because our time is getting short. I will continue and I'll skip this part here. I move on now to another seminal teaching by the Baal Shem Tov that forms the basis of all subsequent Hasidic contemplations on language and its power. You have the translation here on Rachel Elior's book. I would like to just look at the beginning of it in order to present the general idea. The teaching is based on these verses describing the Tevat Noah's Ark. The verse says, Soa ta'aseh lecha leteva, va'alama techalena milamala, ufetach ha'teva b'tzida tasim, tachti'im shni'im u'shlishi'im. The verse instructs Noah on how to build the ark, but of course the word ark, teva, also means word. The Baal Shem Tov reads this verse in order to say something basic about words, and that is that they have various stories. They have a first story and a second story and a third story, and each of them, of those different levels of words, relates to different aspects of reality. Olamot, neshamot, elokut. without going too much into the esoteric meaning of all of those things, I'd like to just look here at the end of the this teaching, where he moves on to the concluding verse of Hashem's instructions to Noachan about how to build the ark, where he says, "Uba'ata u'kol beitcha el ha'teva." Now bring yourself and all of your home, your household, to the word. The way that the Baal Shem Tov interprets this verse is that when you come to your words, whether they be words of Torah or words of prayer, bring your whole self there. Words in short are closed, like the ark is closed. It's closed, it's impermeable. Words without being interpreted don't mean anything, but words have an opening. That's the tzohar, the opening or the skylight that's built into the ark. If you can't get into the word through its immediate opening, its apparent meaning, look for another meaning on the side of it. And that's the opening to the ark is put there in the side. The teaching, I guess, one of its main important aspects is that it indicates the endless potential of interpretation. It depends on how much one wants to understand, and it depends in one's ability to find the opening. But the bottom line is that when one is able to penetrate the word or open the word, it's a source of light. It illuminates the world, one's own understanding, and that's, I guess, the big draw of engaging with language, that is potentially satisfying in that it brings one farther along in connection to Hashem and in connection to Torah. Okay. I'll move on now to the second topic that I'd like to talk about. Now that we've spoken in general about prayer and about language and the power of language, one of its main applications, of course, is in the way that we use words in order to pray, to speak with Hashem, to express everything that needs to be expressed in terms of the Jewish vision of the present and of the future. Okay, so I'd like to talk about three aspects of prayer here. The first one is one that apparently was troubling to the Baal Shem Tov himself. Certainly anyone who's seen Hasidim pray would note the same feature of Hasidic prayer. And here in this first teaching, the Baal Shem Tov relates to it directly. Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, may he rest in peace, said, "When a man is drowning in the river and makes wild gestures to try and save himself from the waters that threaten to sweep him away, surely people who see him will not mock him and his movements. So when is praying and making gestures, such a person should not be ridiculed as he struggles to save himself from the stormy waters, that is, the klipot, the evil husks that come to distract his thoughts while he prays." Now, of course, this is a major issue that the Hasidic masters devoted an enormous amount of attention to, which is the alien thoughts that try to distract a person from prayers. There are many techniques that were suggested about how to do that. But what I'm pointing at now more is that, in addition to the words of prayer, there's a bodily gestures which are an integral part of the whole battle of praying. In other words, it's difficult to pray. It's difficult to keep oneself focused. And the activity of prayer involves more than just the words. It involves engaging the whole self in keeping that connection to Hashem. The next teaching, I think, presents a very sort of human aspect of the whole difficulty of praying. The Baal Shem Tov, this is a teaching by Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, citing his master. I'll read here the Hebrew too, because I think that it's enlightening in what it the way that he expresses the the problem that he's discussing. Mimori shamati, inyan hachayot ratzo v'shov. We spoke about this last week, this notion of the creatures running and returning. We talked about it last week as an aspect of spiritual life in general. Now here the Baal Shem Tov applies it directly to the experience of prayer. Ki haneshama achar shechutzva mimakom kodesh, ra'ui shetitlehev tamid el makom achtavta. Because the soul is made from the divine upper world, it always yearns to return to its source. I'll translate a little bit here, because Hashem decided to clothe the body in matter in order to enable it to exist in this world. So that the soul would not be in continual burning in its worship of Hashem. And all this is for the purpose of rectifying the body together with the soul. When you have anything that gives you pleasure, but you do it continually, it doesn't give you pleasure anymore. ולכן האדם עולה ויורד בעבודת השם יתברך, כדי שיהיה תענוג שהוא עיקר עבודת השם, כמו ששמעתי ממורי. And this is the reason, because continual pleasure is not pleasure, that's why a person has ups and downs in religious life, because otherwise there wouldn't be any desire for a connection. It's really a rather radical statement. Rather than saying, I guess, as we would say normatively, that one is supposed to be devoted to Hashem in everything that one does, and if one ceases to be devoted, that's a loss. The Baal Shem Tov has a more integral approach, in which he says, just as the hachayot ratzo v'shov, as they run and return, so it's totally natural and indeed even necessary that a person have the highs and lows of religious life, that together creates a complex that's called smallness and greatness, katnut v'gadlut. In effect, it's a mechanism that runs the universe, like the web, the ebb and the flow of the tide, or the cycles of the moon. Spiritual life goes in an unfluctuating rhythm, and when one can accept that, not only is it less frightening when one can't make the religious connection that's needed, but in effect, that distance becomes something that's part of a larger whole. So that's certainly a more human approach to prayer, which brings it down into this world. Even if we're talking about the desire for dvekut, for cleaving to Hashem, part of that is the running and returning, the distance and the proximity, which together creates this new concept of dvekut, of devotion to Hashem that the Baal Shem Tov promoted. Okay, now I think I need to present a third aspect of prayer, which is much less esoteric than what we've seen below, what we've seen to this point, but it's because it's so well known and because it was such an important aspect of Hasidism, I am bringing it here. This is a story that appears in many different versions. I think that maybe I won't read it with you today. You have it here on your page. You can read it afterwards. I'll just sort of summarize it. It's a story about a boy who had very limited intelligence. He had a flute that he would keep with him, and he would play it when he tended the flocks. And when he became bar mitzvah, his father was afraid that if he stayed at home, that he might eat. So on Yom Kippur, that he would stay at home and he would violate the fast and he would eat because he didn't know any better. So the father took him with him to shul and he forced him to keep the flute in his pocket. And a few times in the course of the prayers, the boy said that he wanted to play the flute, and the father tried to keep him from violating the holy day by playing an instrument. And so he prevailed until near the end of the tefillah, near Ni'ilah. And the father held the child's pocket to keep the boy from taking out the flute and playing it. But before he reached before the prayer leader, who happened to be the Baal Shem Tov, reached the end of the prayer, the boy forced the flute out of his pocket and blew a blast so loud that all who heard it were taken aback. And then the story concludes, when the Baal Shem Tov heard the sound, he shortened his prayer. And afterwards he said, "With the sound of this flute, the child lifted up all the prayers and eased my burden. Because of the strength of his longing, he played the note of his heart truly for the whole soul's sake of the name of God. And by grace of that sound, which wasn't even a prayer at all, the child lifted all of the other prayers." So here we have, I guess, the ultimate transcendence of language. Whereas language has all of the powers that we talked about before, beyond words, the longing of the heart is really what connects most effectively to Hashem. This text, of course, doesn't contradict the things we said before, but it does present another important aspect of Hasidic prayer, which is that the intellect or the meaning of the words or the technical aspects of performing the mitzvah are certainly not the main thing. To the extent that here we have a violation of a number of halachot, and yet the Baal Shem Tov, as someone who knows Hashem's will, avers that indeed this is the most appropriate kind of service to Hashem, more than anything else that anyone else with all their knowledge was able to accomplish. Okay, so from here I would like to go on to my third topic, which is Torah study. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, and as many of you have pointed out, Torah study was the main, I think, the central bone of contention between the Hasidism and its opponents. Specifically, the idea of Torah Lishma. Now, what Torah Lishma, usually translated as Torah for its own sake, what that actually means in Jewish sources is something that's not quite clear. We see it obviously in the Gemara. It's mentioned in a number of instances, in which, and then later in medieval thought, the general definition of Torah study being for its own sake would be in contrast to Torah study in order to receive a reward, whether it's reward for in this world or reward in the world to come. And against the idea that Torah study is something that gains one power or status or admiration. So Torah study, Lishma, for its own sake, is presented as a religious ideal and something that any other form of Torah study that's not Lishma is considered something a problematic or secondary status. Now, in the earliest published works of Hasidic teaching, we find radical expressions of Hasidic attitudes toward Torah study, which I think once we have a look at them, you'll agree with me that they're provocative. And indeed, these teachings that we're going to look at now in the books that I was quoting from are actually not collections of sermons. They belong to a different genre of Hasidic teaching called Sifrut HaHanhagot, conduct literature. These books were published as small, cheaply produced booklets, and they received very, very wide circulation. The first of them, one of them, Hanhagot Yesharot, it was published in, I think, in 1993. Another book that we'll look at, Yosha Dibrei Emet, was published in 1792. They were a major mechanism in disseminating Hasidic teaching over a wide geographical area. They were cheap. People could buy them and learn them. And of course, the opponents to Hasidut had easy access to them. And indeed, most of these books were burned in the late 17th century and the early 18th century. So what is it in them that is in fact so radical? First of all, I guess we need to point out that the central bone of connection of contention was the Hasidic idea of dvekut, of cleaving to Hashem, which we talked about last week. In the result of the Hasidic desire to, or encouragement to be continually connected to Hashem, it suggested that if one learned Torah, meaning Gemara, one would have to stop being connected to Hashem, stop praying, or stop being involved in spiritual activity in order to engage oneself in intellectual activity. So it's clear that if the normative definition of Jewish activity is going to be engagement with the revealed Torah, with the oral Torah, then the Hasidic approach to Dveikut and to the secondary importance of Torah learning, of course, would be something that would be offensive, to say the least, worse, to say, even in a larger sense. This first source here was one of the most widely cited incendiary statements that appear in Hasidic literature. I read here from a translation by Immanuel Etkas in his book on the Baal Shem Tov. And there's one more principle: not to study a great deal. For in the first generations, when they had powerful minds, they did not need to trouble themselves about reverence. The reverence is yirah. As reverence was continually present to them, and they were able to study a great deal. But we who have weaker minds, if we let our thoughts drift from their dvekut with God, blessed be He, and we study a great deal, heaven forfend, a great deal, heaven forfend, we may stop thinking about the reverence of God. Therefore, one should limit one's study and constantly think of the greatness of the Creator, and not think many thoughts in one's mind, but only the one thought. Okay, so this is the first expression of the preference of dvekut for dvekut leading to a diminished interest in studying Torah, Talmud, in the normative sense. A second point of contention, it entails a social critique. And we see here really a different kind of rhetoric appearing in these Hasidic sources that we haven't seen earlier in the reading that we've done of Hasidic, the sermons. I'd like to just read some lines from the following passages, again, from contact literature. ובאמת רבים מבני עמנו המדומים בעיניהם ובעיני העולם חכמים גדולים בתורה בנגלה ובנסתר ומדומים ביראה ובכל הדברים וסוברים שבאו לקצת התורה ויראה אבל באמת עדיין לא זכו אפילו לידיעה קטנה מתורת אלוקותו שהיא נקראת תורה השם שמורה הנעלם שהוא ישם מתברך. He's saying that there are some people who think that they're great Torah scholars, both in the revealed and in the concealed Torah. And we must remember that many of the Torah scholars of the 18th century were great scholars, both of Gemara and Poskim and of Kabbalah. So he's saying here that although they think themselves to be great, very great, they don't know a single thing about yirah, about reverence. And all of their greatness is in their own eyes. Later on, he says that really they've only reached the chitzoniyut Torah, the external aspect of the Torah. And what they don't know at all is anything that has to do with dvekut. They don't know about ahava and yirah, about love of Hashem and fear of Hashem. Because all of that, he says, hubalev adam. Those are things that happen within the heart. And you see here, he quotes the Rambam, that love of Hashem is expressed emotionally. You can't express love of Hashem by intellectual engagement with anything that you're trying to learn. Here we see in the second quote here, he says something along the same lines, that that Dvekut is the central and most important activity that one needs to be engaged with here. And anyone who learns Torah without that total devotion and love and connection to Hashem, it's as if his things are, his Torah is, that he's engaging with Devoim Betelim. Why are they Betelim? From the word Batel, idle things, because they have no inner vitality. They're not even Divrei Torah, because they don't connect a person to Hashem and to his greater wisdom. Now, in essence, Rabbi Meshulam Feivesheller, what he's getting at is that this sort of learning, because it's only the learning of the opponents to Hasidism, the traditional intellectual kind of learning, is something that happens in the head, but it has no vitality in the sense that it can't really change a person. It can't change a person, it can't change anything about the world. And for that reason, it doesn't bring one to any greater state of religiosity than one was it without that. I will conclude here with something maybe a little bit less blatantly. I want to make a few concluding words. I very briefly translated these. You can look at them afterwards in the Hebrew, and you really see that the language of them is very provocative. They're veiled attacks on the Lithuanian ideals of Torah study. And of course, we should note that the Gaon of Vilna himself was up in arms because of statements like these. And his student, Reb Chaim of Volozhin, in fact, composed Nefesh HaChaim in order to combat or to respond to many of the statements that the Hasidim made about Torah study, in the attempt to show that the Lithuanian tradition of study attained the same goals, only in a slightly different way. So that, of course, is not the topic of our conversation today. I have about 3 more minutes. I'm not going to really have time to do justice to this last citation here, but I would like to at least just put it here on the paper. The Magid of Mezrich speaks as well as about this essential concept of Torah Lishma. He interprets it as the Kabbalist did before him: Torah Lishma, Kishma, Lishma, for her sake. Lishma, Torah, for the sake of the Shechina, for the sake of Hashem. And he reiterates ideas that we've discussed above, that all of human actions have to be for the purpose of repair, that the esoteric engagement with Torah is most deeply Torah for its own sake. Okay, I think that I will conclude here, because I know that people have a lot to say, and I'm interested in hearing what you have to say. So thank you very much. I hope this has been more or less comprehensible, despite the density of my sources. Questions? Jay?
Yeah, hi. If you want to take an extra, you know, couple minutes to expand, you can, but hold on. Let me just see the questions here. I can feed you the questions. Give me 1 second. Okay, hold on. There's all these comments to me. Hold on.
There's also the raised hands in the.
Oh, yes. So, yes, you can speak. Go ahead and speak. That's good.
Good question. This has been wonderful. In Shabbat, in Torah study, we learned about the parable of the cave with Rav Shimon. And I'm just wondering if that's been ever used in the context of this critique of being totally involved in Torah study. Because, of course, you know, that's what he does in the cave with his son for all those years. And it's kind of like almost Plato's cave. And in one way, he's only seeing shadows. And then he comes out to the light and he denigrates what he sees. So to me, that's so in line with the critique you were just talking about. I was wondering if that was ever specifically made in the literature.
Well, right. I mean, Rabbi Shimon, he comes out and he denigrates what he sees, but then he's sent back in again for 12 more years until he can get it right. So basically, I mean, if we're talking about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that he bestowed mystical teaching in all, in a full sense on the world, he needed those years of not seeing anything and looking within and not being involved in the world in order to have access to those secrets. But I guess on a Hasidic reading of that story, when he comes out again, he's able to make that integration, to apply what he's seen to the world itself, to interpret both the Torah and life. So it doesn't contradict it. I think it actually reinforces the idea that I'm talking about. But definitely the cave, Plato's cave and Rabbi Shimon's cave, that's something that unfortunately is not a new idea.
Okay, just here, just somebody pointing out, I guess, the Misnagdim, the idea that they would argue how traditional learning can also bring a person to a higher level of spirituality. In other words, why would the Hasidim say that?
Why would they do
that? Well, that's what you alluded to.
Yeah, I think that there are two answers. One is experiential and the other is mystical. The difference, if you ask the Hasidim, is that the main goal of Torah learning is to change the person. It's not only to change a person, to develop spiritually, to understand more about Hashem and about life. And in addition to that, you have the revealed aspect of learning more Torah and having more Torah knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think that although certainly Reb Chaim in Nefesh HaChaim, it came very close to adopting and adapting many of the most powerful aspects of Hasidic teaching and sort of annexing them into the Lithuanian world. While he did that, still the uniqueness or the contribution of the Hasidic view is on the experiential level, which is something that sort of, and for the Hasidim, transcends revealed knowledge.
Okay, I'm not sure. Siva, I'm asking what this part is exactly, but I imagine it's your last part. There's allude to the need to contemplate, meditate on what one reads. I don't know if you're referring to Kavana, the important, I'm not quite sure I quite follow, but the idea of contemplating and meditating what you do, more important than, you know, doing.
Is that a question?
I think so. I'm trying to interpret the question as best I understand it. The question is, does this allude to the need to contemplate, meditate? So I, you know,
meditate has connotations also that are drawn from outside of Jewish tradition, whereas contemplate, I think, means in this, certainly in the Hasidic context, zelit bonen, in other words, to look at letters specifically or words or texts and to discern through that contemplation of something, a deeper meaning. Whereas meditation is something that you can do with your eyes closed without just being involved in yourself. It has a lot of experiential aspects that are foreign to Hasidut. I guess that would be one difference that I could point to.
Okay, she just to follow up, she referring to the point there when you said, therefore one should limit one's study and constantly think of the greatness of the Creator and not think many thoughts in one's minds, but only the one thought. Yeah, that's the importance of, right, the meditation. Okay, contemplation. All right, any other questions? Bakasha? Otherwise, we'll thank you and see you next week, the finale. I don't know if you're going to have to work harder or less hard, as you said at the beginning. And,
yeah, I don't know. I'll let you know afterwards how it goes.
Malim Bekodesh. Malim Bekodesh. So, and everybody's welcome back at 1:30. Ilana Goldstein-Sachs continuing her book on the non-mystical Sefer Root. I think I can say that's a non-mystical work, the Book of Root. And everybody, 1:30, and then tomorrow, our triple header, Marty Lakshin in the morning, followed by Lori Novak, and then like Dr. Sokol in the evening, Thursday, Shuli Mishkin, and the Parsha Shir by Rabbi Shul Robinson of Lincoln Square Synagogue, and then Friday morning, my Shir in Pirkei Avot, and then Sunday, Rabbi Daniel Feldman, and Rabbi Liebtag on Sunday morning, and then back Monday, Arvi Shvat and Mark Shapiro, and that covers us for the whole week. Okay, thank you, everybody. I apologize for the little technical difficulties at the beginning, but we got through that okay. It took a 2-minute break for everybody to contemplate and meditate on what you had set up till then. And then we look forward to seeing you next week. Everybody have a wonderful day, and we hope to see you soon. All the best. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.